You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 27. This thing can blow stuff up. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. In news, we'll be covering the 20th anniversary of Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, the Dodds Furniture Star Trek mattress commercial, movie news and rumors, the results of our Alice Eve poll, and we'll preview two more tracks from 5-Year Missions Year 2. In the feature, we're joined by Brian Finifter and Tristan Riddell to discuss DS9's third season premiere, The Search. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I'm doing great, Chris. Actually, this week was a really big week for me here in Seattle because an event I've really been looking forward to finally happened. On Thursday in Bellevue, Washington, was the Child's Play Dinner Charity and Auction. I don't know how familiar you are with the Child's Play Charity, but I wanted to bring it up real quick on the show.
Yeah, I know a little bit about it from things you've told me in the past, but tell us a little bit more about that event.
Yeah, so it's a charity that was started by these two guys who do the comic strip Penny Arcade. It's a web comic about games, but they started what's basically a gamers charity that benefits children's hospitals. It was just in Seattle, and now it's all over the country. They've been raising an amazing amount of money, and it's the big time of year when charities do big drives, and they're traditionally around Christmas time. So I just wanted to mention this. So far, they've raised about $1.5 million. And then on Thursday, they raised another $350,000. It was wow. Just a big dinner. You know, a lot of people from the gaming community were there. They auctioned off a lot of really incredible geek-focused stuff. I was telling you before the show, they had the Star Trek Enterprise pizza cutter. They had a Tauntaun sleeping bag from Think Geek. So they were not just being sold, but being auctioned for charity. So it was a great event. If any of our listeners were there, I'm sorry I didn't know and didn't go up to you and say hi. But it was a great event. And at this point, I really just want to encourage everyone to go to childsplaycharity.org and check it out and see if it's something you're interested in. It's kind of my pet charity, and so I want to give it a little plug on the show. So see if any of you are as interested in helping out these kids as so many of the people in the gaming community are. So anyway, that was my week. Yeah. It was a big event just a couple of nights ago.
Yeah, sounds like a great cause. So we'll put some links in the show notes for that. And if anyone's interested in Child's Play, find out more and contribute, get involved. And so it sounds like a good week there. Now, that's what you said on Twitter, that you had a Mert night or something like that.
A Mert night.
That you tweeted. I ask you, what is a Mert night? Or I had a Mert of fine or something. It's like
I should also mention that I had a lot of wine at dinner.
Okay.
And that may have made my tweets a little bit more difficult.
All right.
Another plug is for these guys I met who do what's called Gamer Wine. I think you can just find them at gamerwine.com. But it's red and white wine that they found and bottled, but it with gamer centric names like Noob and Gamer Widow.
So they just found this wine and bottled it.
Well, they're wine aficionados, and they wanted to bring a label of wine to the geek culture. And rather than fermenting new wine, I suppose they went out and found good wine labels and basically are reselling it, I suppose, from what they told me. So they found good wine and are selling it under this label. And it's really fantastic stuff. And I had upwards of 5 or 6 glasses of the Stunlock red wine.
Okay, so things are making a lot more sense to me now.
Yes.
And I think at the time that you blamed that on autocorrect, I believe, right? So, but in actuality, it was the wine.
Well, usually I'm... Usually I am awake enough and mentally able enough to go back and correct the autocorrect. I completely missed saying Mert, a Mert night. I don't know. I don't know where that came from.
I thought it was Old English or something. So
how was your week, Chris? How are things in Japan?
It was fine. Yeah, not a lot going on, really. I mean, just, you know, busy as usual. I had a really nice interview yesterday, actually, with Dr. Athena Andreadis, who's an old friend of mine, who's a biologist at UMass Med right now. And some Star Trek fans may remember she wrote a book quite a few years ago called The Biology of Star Trek. I think it was actually called To Seek Out New Life, The Biology of Star Trek. And,
right.
And we sat down and talked for Matter Stream, which will be coming out on this Monday, the next episode of Matter Stream. We talked about the 100-year starship study, which, Greg, you remember, we talked about that on the Ready Room, one of our earlier shows. So that was interesting. But that was that's the main thing I've been doing this week, other than just kind of, you know, the usual stuff. So yeah, it's getting colder, so I'm happy about that. Oh, well, you know, Greg, one of the things that the cold in December reminds me of is back in 1991 when Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, premiered in theaters. And it's really hard for me to believe that it's been 20 years now since this movie came out. Just after we released our last show here on December 6th, we had the anniversary of the premiere date of Star Trek VI. And how old were you at this time, Greg? Do you have any memories of Star Trek VI coming out?
Amazingly, I think I might have mentioned on the show before. I was 5 years old, five and a half, I suppose. You start doing half years when you're that young. And I absolutely remember going to see this movie in the theater. I don't know what my parents were thinking, taking a five-year-old into a movie theater. If I were also in that movie theater, I'm sure I'd be very angry at those dumb Trekkie parents who are taking their child who's much too young. But I absolutely remember seeing it. I remember being blown away by the size of it, because the only Star Trek I'd seen to date was on the little 4x3 television in our living room. Mm-hmm. So I don't remember the plot from it, but I do remember this was one of the first films I actually saw in theaters, and it did blow me away. What were your remembrances of Six?
Six for me, it's I remember going to all the Star Trek movies in the theater, but Six for me has always been a memory that stuck with me because of the plot. I mean, like you just said there, 1991, I had just returned from the Soviet Union, where I had gone and studied music for a while. And while I was in the Soviet Union, I was actually in Moscow. I went to the Tchaikovsky Conservatory in Moscow, and I was there during the coup when they put Gorbachev under house arrest, and they had the whole stand in front of the Russian White House with Yeltsin and all. And it was quite an experience. And that was in the summer of 91. And I came back to the university in Alabama. And then this movie came out, December that year. And the theme of this movie is so much a parallel to the Cold War, to the events that kind of led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Right. And also at the time, I don't think many of our listeners know, they know that I'm a musician. What they probably don't know is that I have a degree in Russian language, and I studied, you know, Soviet politics and all this, what I studied in university. And so this had a really personal connection for me. And I remember going with all my friends, in university to see this theater. Mm-hmm. And it's always, maybe because of those connections, been one of my very favorite of the original series movies.
Yeah, I don't think I realized until, you know, I guess what I should set this up by saying that I watched most of the Star Trek movies and the shows in a big clump in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it wasn't until recently that I've gone back and watched everything again, and I've looked at the historical context of these movies, and it really didn't hit me, I think, until last year, that the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall and all of that was right when this movie was coming out. Like, I knew it was related, but it really, this was, must have been a really, when people went to go see it in the theater, they didn't just know exactly what they were talking about. They were constantly reminded of headlines while watching the Star Trek film. And I don't think there's not another Star Trek film that really does that. You know, Star Trek IV maybe definitely reminds you of a lot of the environmentalism of the time and being worried about saving the planet. But this one was possibly the episode or film of Star Trek that nailed it on the head as far as saying, we want to say something really important about current events. And And for that reason, this is definitely my favorite Star Trek film. You know, it reaches a level that none of the other movies really do, just for that reason alone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's very true. It was very much what was happening in the world at the time. And it just happened that they could draw that great parallel between the Federation and the Klingons. And also remember at this time, the Next Generation was in its, was it maybe fourth season? Fourth or fifth season? This was around the time of Unification as well. Of the episodes with Unification. And but at any rate, you know, in the Next Generation, we have Worf on the Enterprise. We have this kind of uneasy... the Federation, the Klingons are friendly, but we don't know how they got there, really.
Right.
I mean, we kind of know from the original series with the Organian Peace Treaty and this, but it still doesn't seem to make any sense. And this was a rare case where the original series cast could actually kind of fill in the backstory for the Next Generation when the Next Generation was on the air and going forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering your thoughts on, should this have been the final original series film? Did you feel that it wrapped everything up, or did you want to see those characters go on and see more?
No, this should have been it. What happened in Generations should have never happened. So, and I don't say that because I'm upset about, you know, Kirk dying or anything. It's just this movie was the perfect send-off. For the way this movie ended in particular was the perfect send-off for the original series cast. You know, it even ended with what I understand was quite an expensive thing to do at the time, with putting their signatures on the screen at the end. You know, it's just the final lines, you know, second star to the right and straight on till morning. They're passing the torch to a new generation, new crew. And it was a great ending. And I do wish that that had have been the last that we saw of the Unification stuff on Next Generation. I don't mind too much because that had a legitimate purpose, you know, with Spock being, you know, trying to unite the Romulans and the Vulcans and all. But as far as Kirk and seeing other characters later, yeah, this should have been the last for sure.
Right. Mm. Yeah, I definitely can't disagree with that too much. I would have loved to see further films in the time period, you know, more things filling in that gap, as we say, between, I guess, that first scene in Generations and then the beginning of Next Gen. There's those lost years, and I would love to see something go back and fill those in. But this was such ending it on a high note. You know, it's like Seinfeld calling it quits after season 7. It's, we know we're at the top of our game as far as making, I mean, sure, Star Trek 5 wasn't great, but they'd made some great ones, and they made this one, and it was phenomenal. And it was time for them to finish. You know, doing any more would have been, I think, a disservice. It would have been dragging it out.
Yeah, yeah, I agree that it would be interesting to see some movies that fill, would have been great to see some movies that fill in that time period between this and Generations. But maybe not necessarily with Kirk and his crew. But I think what you're probably saying is that the what happened during history that led up to that would be interesting to know. Yeah, for sure.
What I'm saying is I'd like to see a series of films with Captain Sulu.
Oh, you want to have that. So you wanted, instead of Enterprise, you wanted to have the Excelsior series.
Yes. It was just going to be called Hikaru. Star Trek Hikaru.
And then the studio would come in and say, you know, I don't think it's working with just the name Hikaru, so let's call it Star Trek Hikaru, and ratings are going to soar through the roof after that. So, yeah, I know what you're saying.
There we go.
So, Greg, one thing that I also have fond memories of from my days living back in Alabama are local commercials, because we don't really get a lot of those, or any of those really, in Japan. But, of course, American TV has fantastically cheesy local commercials for a variety of products, and especially furniture.
Yeah. Who was it that found this for us? On Twitter, I believe one of our friends picked up this link.
Yeah, this was one of our very cool followers, Kathy B, the Shazamator.
Oh, yes.
Who found this. She sends a lot of interesting things our way. And this commercial is for Dodd's Furniture, which is a local furniture company in Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. And this is some real classic Star Trek stuff right here.
Right. Now, this is not to be confused with our incoming Tide sponsorship, but this is Serta Trek, based on the mattresses that I suppose you can find at Dodd's Furniture. Yeah. I don't know how to describe this commercial. Really, if you're listening to our show and you haven't seen the commercial, you really should pause, go watch it, and come back.
There's a link on the show page, so definitely.
Yeah, it's just, it is phenomenal. It's one of those things that's so bad that you actually realize that it knows how bad it is, and it becomes good. It becomes good again by the end of it. So
right,
it's amazing. What's the great line by the captain at the end? I believe it's "Live long and sleep."
Yeah, live long and sleep. I like. There are some other good lines in here. You can choose your space with a Serta. which, if you think about it, doesn't even make any sense. But
no,
somehow,
it really doesn't.
Somehow, within the context of this commercial, it works. Boldly dream like you've
right.
never dreamed before. And I think this
Captain,
is where, like,
what does he say, Captain? Will we not be undersold?
Yeah, make it so. Right. There's one point where one of the guys, and he's, I think, a red shirt, is like cuddled up with a tribble in the bed.
Yes.
And of course, what I was thinking was, where's the glamour? But
right,
he looks awfully comfortable with that tribble.
Oh my goodness, I don't know what you're implying.
But one of my other favorite parts about this is early in the commercial, they do a cutscene to the ship flying through space, and it's the Enterprise. The hull, the nacelles, and all are the Enterprise, but the saucer section is a giant Serta mattress. And I was thinking that would have been absolutely perfect in Generations, so that when Troy crashes the ship, it would have been a very soft landing for everyone.
Wow. Wow. We're going to get so much hate mail. What I liked was the blatant use of a image of the Enterprise they found on Google, you know. That's just... You know,
well,
they don't have copyright in Canada, right? That's not a thing.
Well, if it's a parody, it's fine. I mean, parodies are exempt from copyright. So, but one thing Kathy pointed out here too was that how nice it is the way that they mix the original series and the Next Generation elements together.
Right.
You notice they scan the mattress with the TNG tricorder while they're wearing TOS uniforms. And I think the Klingons may be a mix. The Klingons, it really reminded me a lot like the Beverly Hillbillies a little bit there.
Right. Yeah. Let's just say the makeup, they could have spent more on pre-production and a little less on post-production with the Klingon makeup.
Maybe so. But just don't forget what they tell you. Don't cling on to that old mattress.
Oh goodness.
But this is a real treat. So we'll put a link in the show notes. You have to go watch this. And if you go to the
Definitely.
YouTube channel of Dodd's Furniture, they've actually done more commercials. They have 22 up there. They have Superman, James Bond, Spider-Man, The Roadrunner. The Price is Right, which I didn't watch yet, but just from the thumbnail of it, it's like Dodd. I guess the captain here is Dodd himself. Wearing this like really terrible looking gray wig to look like Bob
yeah.
Barker. So, and there's a Bollywood one also.
Yes, they look fantastic. I think after the show, I'm going to go and watch them for a couple hours. So definitely follow our link.
Well, you know what else is fun, Greg, is 5-year missions takes on all the original series episodes. And as we've been doing each week, we're going to preview a couple more tracks. And at this point, many of our listeners have already heard the album because it is finally out in the hands of people who pre-ordered and even available on iTunes as of a couple of days ago.
Yeah, I'm seeing so many tweets of people finally getting their hands on it and professing their love of year two. And it's really glad to see this finally getting out there to wider distribution. Have you checked to see if it's on the iTunes yet?
Yeah, I did last night, and it's right up there, right alongside year one for $9.99.
Perfect.
So you can get instant gratification by just clicking buy in iTunes. And Greg, I know you and I have both been listening to it for, I don't know, about 6 weeks or more now since mm-hmm. we got our hands on a copy. And as you are listening through it, and especially the tracks we'll preview today, I just want to give you one piece of advice.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to tell you, just Greg, just don't fight the sunny feeling. Just enjoy being high.
Nice.
Which, of course, is a line from This Side of Paradise. So yep. Let's play a clip of that. So this is one of the fun tracks on the album, Greg. It's one of those, like we talked about with Court Martial. Actually, I don't remember if we talked about Court Martial on here yet or not, but it's that take of kind of a very cheerful take on the episode where, you know, in this case, these flower spores, I believe they are, have kind of influenced, intoxicated the crew, and everyone's kind of feeling like they're in heaven. You know, it's... It's like another one of Star Trek's drug-induced moments, you know, like the slingshot effect. And
drugs make you feel good, Wesley. Tasha Yar joined us for a moment.
Yeah, the more you know. So, and in here, I like this kind of upbeat take that they have on this episode. It's fun, and I love this line. Don't fight the sunny feeling, just enjoy being high. Great advice if you ever find yourself in the situation where flower spores have intoxicated you, and you might want to hang around on the farm there.
I feel like that happened a little too much on Star Trek, that flowers in real life have magical feelings, magical effects on people.
I haven't had that personal encounter, but it just certainly does happen a lot on the original series. And even when it doesn't, like in The Man Trap, you've got that flower in Sulu's quarters where it's like very obviously someone's hand in a pink glove squeezing their hand back and forth.
Yes.
One of the great moments of The Man Trap. You've really got to watch out for flowers if you go on any kind of away missions in the original series.
Noted.
And the other thing you have to look out for is molten lava. And this comes in with the next track that we'll play, which is The Devil in the Dark.
I'm a doctor, not a bricklayer.
Ah, yeah. That's very applicable to this episode for sure. And Five-Year Mission's take on Devil in the Dark, this is one before the album came out, I was wondering what they were going to do with it. And it's definitely the most unusual track on this album, without a doubt, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, definitely. It stuck in my head, that long chorus. It's not really the song I expected. I really expected something upbeat and jumpy for the Horda episode for some reason.
Yeah, this one, it's kind of like it would go perfectly if you played this during the drug trip in Star Trek 4 when they slingshot around the sun.
Right.
It's very interesting. It's a good track, and I guess it's the kind of, with the Horda and what was happening to the miners in this episode in The Devil in the Dark, where they were disappearing. It was kind of this unknown, like a terrifying uncertainty that was going on in this facility. And this kind of eerie take here captures that pretty well. And it's in an unexpected way for me.
Yeah, definitely. On a related note, this is an episode I'm really looking forward to seeing in the comic, because I feel like it's another one, sort of how Five-Year Mission took a sort of different take on it that I feel like the episode itself did, or at least my memories of it. I feel like the comic could also do that and take a more serious, or at least harder to laugh at, take on it. Once we are free of the, you know, the 60s sets and styrofoam rocks and everything. There's a really interesting and thought-provoking story in here.
Right. And then Spock also gets to mind-meld with Uhura.
Well, and that's, yes.
One of the great moments as well. All right. So these are two more good tracks from 5-Year Missions Year 2. And like we said a minute ago, it's up in iTunes now. You can find it there. And I'm pretty sure I don't use the other MP3 stores, but I know Mike told us it's going to be available in the other places where you can get MP3s as well.
Yeah.
And of course, you can go to 5yearmission.net and find it there too. And we'll have links in the show notes. Okay, so Greg, it's now time. I don't know if we have any real production value on this yet, but we will someday. Time to play Star Trek Movie Rumors. Rumors.
My favorite part of the show. Oh, man. I don't know if you heard our friends at the Zero Room podcast actually had their own Star Trek Movie Rumors segment this week. It's well worth checking out their podcast for the last episode and hearing their thoughts on these casting rumors that we're going to talk about today.
Okay, yeah, I haven't heard that one yet. Are there any like juicy tidbits from their thoughts that you want to share, or
send everybody over there? Yeah, they're not coming to me at the moment. I don't want to misquote them, and I'm afraid I would.
To go check it out. Okay.
Yes, they didn't seem to be aware that Del Toro was in talks to play Uhura, but I guess that's okay because apparently those talks have broken down.
Yeah, apparently so. Now, did they know that Alice Eve is playing Scotty?
I think that's been widely reported on the wires. So
okay, so they maybe know that one. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Apparently Del Toro is out. We heard from New York Magazine's Vulture. Actually, I saw this on TrekNews.net that New York Magazine's Vulture cited that the two parties, being Del Toro and studio, were unable to come to monetary agreement for the role, and so he's out. And
right.
You know, I don't know if this is straight money, or I saw someone else mentioning that maybe it has something to do with merchandising, like getting a percentage of merchandising or things like that, which I think is quite possible.
Hmm.
But they apparently weren't able to reach an agreement. And so now JJ has two more actors in his sights to play the lead villain, and they both happen to be Latino. One is Spanish, one is Venezuelan as well.
Yeah, I feel like last week, the two things we were sure of were that Benicio Del Toro was going to be in the film and that he was not going to be playing Khan.
Right.
And I feel like now that kind of has to be reversed. That unless they really are going for South Tolosian police commissioner, I don't see a reason that they're only trying out Latino actors for a role in a major Star Trek film.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it does seem that way. I mean, I'm still hoping that it's not Khan. It does seem that way. I know some people are upset by the idea that if it's Khan and they're limiting themselves to Latino actors because Ricardo Montalban played Khan before, where, of course, the character of Khan is actually supposed to be of Indian descent.
Yes, exactly.
Right, so... But
Star Trek kind of famously doesn't have the exact correct nationality play the exact correct nationality. So that's
sort of a
classic thing. So one thing I did want to mention is that a lot of people have been complaining about how are they going to do. This is one thing mentioned on Zero Room is how are they going to do Wrath of Khan again? Because there isn't the backstory from Space Seed to draw upon. And I actually think this goes into what they actually could be doing with this movie is going ahead and showing that first meeting of Kirk and Khan. So don't think of this, if they do go in this direction, don't think of it as a retread of Wrath of Khan at all. Just simply using the Khan character in a brand new story, which I do think could actually be quite interesting.
Right. That is true. And I think that is something that people are missing. I think there's so much focus on it's the second movie in this new franchise. The second movie in the original series franchise was The Wrath of Khan, and now maybe there are rumors it's Khan, so they're just going to do Wrath of Khan, and it's going to be like the comic books, and you know, the first half or two-thirds of the movie are going to be exactly the same as it was the first time, and then something different is going to happen at the end. And
right.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I see people in comment threads and all, like over at trekmovie.com, some readers who are posting there, you know, making comments like, you, JJ's stupid and they've lost me now, and I can't believe that they're so dumb that they think they can just remake The Wrath of Khan. And I think that is being a bit short-sighted and uncreative yourself in thinking about what they might
right.
do. I mean, they could be doing Space Seed again, or like you said, they could be doing something totally different where Khan and Kirk do meet, but things play out in a totally different way.
Yeah. I would love to see Kirk and Khan be friends or closer to friends for a substantial amount of the movie. I mean, I'd love to see them give them both a common enemy to fight against. And so they sort of have to team up. And then, sure, Khan can turn on him and there can be the whole thing. And they could even leave them on SETI Alpha 3 or 4. I forget which one.
Okay. You're getting close.
If I keep counting up numbers, I'll eventually
right.
hit the correct one.
That's
this
right.
was SETI Alpha 5. So I feel like they can still leave them there. It's fine. But they can create a story that's absolutely nothing like anything we've seen. You know, we saw Enterprise do a story with augments that was nothing at all like Space Seed. It's, I mean, kind of like Space Seed, but really not anything like Space Seed or Wrath of Khan. So there's plenty of directions to go in that aren't retreads of anything and won't trample on memories or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So the actors that are in the running now, reportedly, and this could all change by the time we actually get this show out, because that's what happened to us last week. You know, we
yes.
talked all about Del Toro, and then the day of or day after we released this show, by the time we got the show out, the news broke that Del Toro was out. But so we have
I think
Edgar
I asked you if we should do a special news bulletin.
Yeah,
Del Toro out. Khan in.
Yeah, I don't know how we would do that other than maybe we could have it like an autoplay audio file. So every time you load a page on Trek FM, it goes,
right.
Del Toro out.
Exactly.
That's it. You know, people that read the site at work, you know, would just love us for that.
Oh, I'm sure they would.
So apparently Edgar Ramirez, who is a Venezuelan actor, who is considered the current front runner here, and I don't know much about him myself personally. I see his photo here and trying to picture him as Khan. And then there is the next actor now. Do you know how to pronounce his name?
His name is Jordi Mola. And I actually recently saw Jordi in Colombiana, which starred Zoe Saldana. And if you haven't actually seen Colombiana, I really super recommend it. It is a fantastic film. And I do remember Mola being in it and being pretty good, actually.
Right. Yeah, I haven't seen that myself. It does raise the question for me, though, that if he is cast, is there going to be a competition who gets to hug and make out with Zoe Saldana between Spock and the villain?
I won't get into it, but Zoe Saldana has a certain predilection for men in these movies, and I don't think she'll be going anywhere near another man other than Spock. She seems to have eyes for him only. She picks a man in a movie, and just that's her guy, and nothing ever. It's sort of like every man's dream that the moment Zoe Saldana sees you, she's drawn to you, and she never wavers, and she's there by your side. I don't know if that's your dream, but that's certainly my dream.
Okay. Well, I tell you, a lot of things coming out in this ready room, as you'll find out in the feature as well.
Yes.
Right. All right. Okay. So, well, I don't know, you know, if either of these guys are going to get in the movie or if we're going to find out that they're going after somebody else, you know, maybe, I don't know, Jon Stewart's going to be the villain or... Who knows where we're going right now? It almost concerns me a little bit because now the studio has announced a release date for the movie.
Yeah.
And And they're apparently in the very final stages of the script, just doing a few rewrites just to make sure they're on budget, from what I understand. And yet they're trying to cast the main villain. And it worries me a little bit that they're going to like grab somebody because they're out of time.
Right.
And we may not get the strongest performance that we could get if they had started earlier on that. But
the thing I point everyone to is Lord of the Rings. And I remind everyone that Viggo Mortensen came in to play Aragorn with like 2 days notice that he was going to be even in the film, much less having been given the script. And day one, he nailed it. And throughout the entire series, he was the best part of the entire film series. So yes, there can be a problem, but you think of Lord of the Rings, the guy they had picked and had thought about for a long time, he ended up being not the right guy. So there are so many factors that go into casting that it's hard to tell what's going to work. And it wouldn't surprise me if they just need to do screen tests and get people on set before they're really going to have an idea of who's really going to be right for this role.
Right. And we all remember what happened with Voyager, with Captain Janeway in that respect as well. So, okay, well, we have another Star Trek veteran who has been cast in the movie now. That's Peter Weller, who people know as RoboCop, of course. And he also played the Terra Prime leader, John Frederick Paxton, in the Enterprise episodes Demons and Terra Prime, which was the actual finale to Enterprise.
Exactly. As far as I'm concerned, the last episodes of Enterprise ever produced
featured Peter Weller.
Yes, and I think he was really quite good in Enterprise. I don't know if I've seen him in too many things, but this will definitely continue the trend of rehiring Enterprise actors, or not just Enterprise actors, but Star Trek actors in general. You know, they put him in a bit role in an episode and suddenly say, you know what? He'd be really good in this big movie role that we're doing next year.
Now, we don't know what he's going to play in the movie. Do you have any speculation?
I bet he'll just be an admiral. I don't expect him to be a villain or anything.
No, not a villain.
He does have the look of one of those random ensigns from Voyager that's way too old to still be an ensign. But
yeah, you somehow mean like Harry Kim in season 36 of Voyager? Yes.
But
yeah, I know what you mean.
But no, I do see Peter Weller being more of an admiral's role. We'll see.
You do wonder about those ensigns that are really old. Like, how do you manage to not get promoted for so long?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Even the guy in which episode was it where Wesley has to run that group of scientists, and there's an ensign there who looks to be, you know, he's a good 15 years older than Wesley. And I'm just thinking, you know, if you're so special and so smart and can tell Wesley what to do, why are you still an ensign? You know, Wesley's an ensign and he's like 13 and a half.
That's right. Not only is he an ensign at 13 and a half, but he's Picard's go-to guy whenever the ship's in trouble and needs to be flown to safety, right?
Right. It's exactly. He's like,
Wesley, take the helm.
Right. It's like he calls down to engineering. Geordi, the warp drive appears to be offline. Can you find Wesley and see if you can fix it?
That's right. Oh, gosh. Okay, well, also while we're talking about the movie, we have no clue what's actually going on with the villain or who's going to play it or whether it's really Khan or not. But what we do know is that Alice Eve has joined the cast, and we talked about that last week, but we've been running a poll to find out from our readers and listeners what they think in terms of who Alice Eve will play. So, Greg, I have the current results for you here.
Oh, great. I can't wait to hear.
Okay, so, well, leading the poll with 35% is an all-new character. And, of course, as we talked about last time, within the same sentence, basically, news reports have given us the fact that she will be a character that is new to the franchise, but someone with whom Trekkies will be familiar.
Right.
Whatever that means. I think that some politician staff writer came up with that sentence.
Right.
It's the classic sentence to negate itself, but
right. Well, as our friend of the show Jose said on Zero Room, they're probably just going to paint him green or paint her green and have her sleep with Kirk and then just move on.
Oh, that's her role in the movie.
Yeah, probably.
Maybe. So 35% say an all-new character. Now, 23% right. say Yeomen Rand.
Mm-hmm.
I personally don't think it's Yeomen Rand because the reports also said that she would be playing a major role. And right. I can't see Yeomen Rand having a major role in the movie. I can see Yeoman Rand being in the movie,
yeah.
but not playing a major role. So I don't think
well,
they would.
Someone has to bring them coffee on the bridge.
That's right. Now, with 19%, the next highest vote getter is Dr. Carol Marcus from The Wrath of Khan.
This is my pick. This is what I would love to see because we never did see that relationship between Kirk and Dr. Marcus that actually led to, you know, them having a son together. We simply saw them later on and dealing with it. So I would love to see, you know, even if it is alternative universe, it still could be their first meeting and them,
yeah.
you know, falling for each other and seeing the ups and downs of the relationship over the course of the film.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think that most of the reason why Dr. Marcus is getting 19% of the vote here is that people are hearing the rumors that it's Khan as the villain. And so they're thinking remake of Wrath of Khan. They need
right.
somebody to play Dr. Marcus. And Alice Eve looks very much like that character. So
mm-hmm.
So that's it. But I think, yeah, like you said, that just because Carol Marcus is in the movie doesn't mean that it's the Wrath of Khan. It could be how Kirk and Carol Marcus
right.
met or later on in their relationship. Maybe we'll get to see the conception of David.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she won't be working on the Genesis device, but, you know, maybe the first and second Samuel device or the, you know,
oh,
it won't
okay.
be a retread
okay.
of Wrath of Khan.
Okay. For sure. So the next vote getter with 4% is Elizabeth Daner from Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Right.
I, you know, the thing is, I think actually you and I talked about this during the week this week when you reminded me that you mentioned Daner last time and I was like really against it. And, but then during the week, you know, I was thinking that in the comic, spoiler here, if you haven't read the comic yet, that Daner is not in the comic. And so she doesn't die in the story of Where No Man Has Gone Before. So they
right.
certainly could bring Daner back to do just about anything. You know, it's,
yeah,
it's
exactly
doesn't have to be that story. The character is still alive and therefore they could bring the character back for whatever purpose they see fit in a movie.
Right. And don't she and McCoy have some sort of past that they
yeah,
hint
they,
at in the comic but don't really get into?
Yeah, they hint at it with just one little passing comment that McCoy makes to Kirk. So they don't go into it in any way at all. So she, yeah, she could come back. There could be something with McCoy, who knows. I found that line in the comic to be a little bit odd because we know in the first movie that McCoy has just gotten divorced and, you know, and I don't know, maybe he was married to Daner. They don't say who he was married to, but
well, that's,
it
that's
seemed
possible.
Like a little bit of a disconnect between what they said in the comic and what happened in the first movie.
I feel like McCoy would have hooked up with quite a few people at the Academy. I mean, we do know from Dax that he was quite a ladies' man, I believe.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So
that's right.
I wouldn't be surprised to hear that there are quite a few many adventures between them. And we don't know, you know, what star bases they stopped off on. Just because you were married and then got divorced doesn't mean you're not still looking for hot young future yeomen and etc.
And scientist, yeah. And scientists. Yeah, that's true. We only know McCoy from the original series where he's much older and,
exactly.
and we don't know what he was like when he was younger. That's true. Okay, well we had three other options on the poll that have all gotten 0% of the vote. And those were T'Pring, Spock's fiance from A Mock Time, mm-hmm. which I just kind of put on there for fun. And of course, I think we talked about this last week, right? How the Vulcans relocate to a planet that turns everyone's hair blonde.
Right.
And
very
then there's your favorite character from a Star Trek movie, Dr. Gillian Taylor, the marine biologist from Star Trek IV.
Of course, it won't be until Star Trek 14 that they do the retread of Star Trek IV. So just, you know, put that casting news on hold.
Right, where they have to go back and find blue whales instead of humpback whales.
Exactly.
To save the future.
Just wait until we have to start doing casting rumors about the punk on the bus. Who's going to play the punk on the bus?
Right. And since that'll be Star Trek 14, by the time we get to that on the show here, you and I will be quite old, and we'll be like Statler and Waldorf sitting up there going, yeah, I think he should play the punk.
I'll definitely be the John C. Dvorak. I remember when tricorders had to be held by two hands. These one-handed tricorders you kids have.
I used to have to wear it around the neck. I used to have two yeomen carry my tricorder around with me as we walked through the snow. All right.
All righty.
Well, I don't want you back to the poll. So the other person who's got zero on there, which kind of surprises me just a little bit, is Lieutenant MacGyvers. And I wonder if that's because people don't know who this character is by name.
That's the character who could solve any engineering problem with just a paperclip and a stick of gum, right?
Yes.
Lieutenant MacGyver.
That's right. And he was Chief Engineer Argyle's drinking buddy.
Exactly.
Oh, no. Lieutenant MacGyvers is the historian in Space Seed who recognized that Khan was a prince and a tyrant from the 20th century, who became involved with Khan and became his wife, was exiled on City Alpha 5 with Khan.
Right.
That's the reason that I put her on this poll, even though the original actress had red hair. Because if they are doing a retelling of Space Seed, she would play into the story.
Right. I love how there are historians on these starships, but they only show up in stories that directly use them for something very specific,
right,
like Space Seed or in whichever episode it was of Next Gen where they go into the holodeck and meet the gangsters.
Yeah.
I'd love to see a series of Star Trek where there's just a historian who just hangs out on the bridge. He's sort of in a big leather chair and he reads books and every once in a while he comments
smokes
on
a pipe.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. They go to the Tholian web and he's like, this is a lot like in the 5th century BC when everyone just rolls their eyes and says, why do we have historians on this ship?
It would be so great. So it's the Tholians, they get this web around here. And so Kirk looks over to Spock and Spock's, got his head buried in his little science viewer there. And he's, trying to report on what he's scanning. And then Kirk looks over to Uhura and Uhura's like, channels are still, I can't raise the other ship. And then he looks over to his left and there's this like black leather lazy boy over there in the corner, and you've got like the historian smoking the pipe and he's got on the sweater and all, and
those half moon glasses
and Kirk's like, so Mr. MacGyvers, can you tell us a little bit about this web? And he goes in about the history of the Tholians, and I mean, this would be some really riveting Star Trek.
It definitely would be.
Maybe the History Channel would be interested in doing the next Star Trek series.
Oh, don't get me started on the History Channel, Chris. Do not.
All right. So besides these choices, 19% of people have voted for other. Mm-hmm. And here are a few of the more interesting other votes that we got. Now, one was Nurse Chapel. Obviously, mm-hmm. I'm not surprised that some people would vote for Nurse Chapel. Also, Chief DeFalco got a vote. Do you even remember who Chief DeFalco is?
Only because you put a very helpful note that she is the relief navigator who replaced Ilya in the motion picture. Without that, I would not have any idea. I wouldn't know her from the guy who replaces Wesley when he leaves the helm.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking that Chief DeFalco was a singer from the 80s. but no, that was DeFalco.
I see.
So, someone voted for anyone but T'Pring.
Oh, my goodness.
which leads me to believe that they would be okay with, say, a young Dr. Pulaski.
Oh, goodness.
or even bringing, Chief Engineer Argyle back as a female. Would be okay with them as long as it's not T'Pring.
As long as it's not T'Pring, yeah.
And then this one, someone from the Prime Universe come to get Prime Spock.
Oh my goodness, that's great. Maybe so she's from the future, like when they're doing the time travel sort of regularly and they just need to bring Prime Spock back to the Prime timeline or else the timeline will be messed up.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Had to bring it back. She works for the Department of Temporal Investigations.
Exactly.
That's at perfect. Starfleet. She's probably, you know, from the 31st century and she's coming back to get Prime Spock. And I just have to say in this other vote here, no bitterness going on here, I can tell from whomever voted for someone from the Prime universe to get Prime Spock.
Well, you know that the plot line for Star Trek 14 will be that they have to go back in time and get Prime Spock and bring him to the future because the Prime Spock probe came to Earth and was threatening to blow it up.
So Greg, two questions here. First of all, what sound does the Prime Spock probe make?
Fascinating.
Oh gosh. Okay. So, and my next question is, what object protrudes from the Prime Spock probe is lowered out?
Well, no, it's just a big hand with the live long and prosper symbol. It just goes live long and prosper Earth.
I get it. And so instead of ionizing the atmosphere as the whale probe did, the Prime Spock probe attempts to mind meld with the Earth's atmosphere, right?
Which is not good. Not good for the Earth's atmosphere, as it turns out.
And as a result, they have to go travel back in time to find Prime Spock, bring him back to set things straight. I tell you, Greg, they really need to hire us to write this stuff.
They really should.
We've been saying it for weeks and months now, and my phone has not rung yet. I don't know about yours, but...
Not yet.
Ah, gosh, but it needs to. Heading into season 4 of Deep Space Nine, that's when DS9, as we've talked about before, shaved the head. Now, prior to that, in season 3, they didn't quite shave the head yet, but they did start trimming the sideburns. And that happened in parts 2 and 3 of the Dominion introduction with The Search. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And of course, Greg is here with me. And we also have friend of the show, Brian Finifter.
Hi, guys.
And Hyper Channel host, Tristan Riddell.
Hello, everyone.
All right, guys. So let's talk a little more about DS9 and talk about The Search as we... it's kind of the beginning of so much of what made DS9 great over the final seasons. I think we have the birth of the Dominion. We have the Defiant, one of the cool ships from Star Trek coming in. A lot of character development for Odo. I guess before I give you any of my thoughts here, let's find out, first of all, who watched this episode when it first aired versus going back and watching it after you already know who the founders are and what happens with the Dominion and so forth?
I watched it when it was first on the air, and it was a lot of fun to, you know, go through the twists and turns of not knowing who really are the founders and not knowing it was a virtual reality when it really was, and watching it now. Like rewatching it for this podcast, it kind of, like, when you see the Vorta turn around and say, "Yeah, I'm a founder," you can't help but just kind of snicker and go, "No, right, yeah. You're not."
Your gullible Federation.
Exactly.
Right.
I feel like I watched this when it was first aired. I think, as we talked about a while ago, I stopped watching somewhere around the Changeling, which is that after this? I don't remember.
I don't remember exactly either.
I think it's before, actually. But So I don't remember whether I watched it when it first aired or not. But I do feel like this is definitely Deep Space Nine blossoming into really the show that it set itself up to be and what it becomes and is what its most strong being in season five, in season four and five. And it's like, okay, this is, we've now reached the real catalyst of this overall arching story of this huge war that you, that now there is absolutely no question that this huge war is going to come and is going to define the rest of the action of the series.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't see the show when it first aired, but I managed to studiously avoid spoilers. I'd go on Memory Alpha and I'd read only the post about the episodes I'd seen so far and avoid all other things. So I didn't really know that the Changelings were the founders, and I didn't know the Vorta. I didn't know all that history. So I managed to get all this story just in one big clump when I watched the show, I guess, last year. And yeah, this is definitely the episode where I started realizing, oh yeah, this is why people really love DS9. It's not just a self-contained episode. It's an episode that references so many things from before and is obviously presaging events that are to come. I mean, it ends on such a, it's a non-ending. It says, you know, all of the things we showed you today might happen or something else might happen, but certainly something interesting is about to happen. So stay tuned.
Yeah, exactly. For me, I saw it on when it was in first run and then watched, you know, all of DS9 in order. And when I went back to watch it, I've watched it many times since, but in particular this time when I went back to watch it to kind of prepare for this discussion, it's kind of like Tristan was saying, when you actually know where all the pieces fall and how everything fits together at the end, you kind of snicker occasionally. I was thinking like, oh, here's, you know, Admiral Nechayev, one of my favorite characters from Star Trek, by the way, and one of yours too, I am very sure. You know, seems so gullible, and the Federation, you think, must be so gullible as well to buy into all this, but it's only because, you know, the backstory and, right. And, you know, the idea that Odo is a founder is kind of an interesting twist for Star Trek as well, that you have this main character who ends up being born of the enemy, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be almost like if the science officer on board one of the first Earth vessels turned out to be actually a member of the species that they became. I'm making a Star Trek Enterprise joke.
Oh, I thought you were talking about species sci-fi.
Species, I don't know actually what you're referring to. Yeah.
That's a very inside joke. Wait, we have one listener who will get that. So
okay, well, good.
Wait, Greg, were you making a T'Pol joke, or what were you saying?
I'm making a T'Pol joke. Like, oh, okay. That would have been a really interesting way to go in Enterprise, yeah, too, and they definitely show it in DS9.
Well, that was going to happen in Season 5, though, right?
Exactly. But here in DS9, they're doing it where you have this character that all along he's been a member of this race, and what I love is that he accepts it, but then when the choice comes, you know, whether to stay with them or go with his friends, he knows exactly what to do. He doesn't have too much difficulty with that. He recognizes where his place is, and I love that choice that he makes.
I think it's an incredible contrived coincidence that this main character happens to be a member of the founders, you know, the very core controllers of what is going to prove to be this whole, you know, series engulfing conflict. But it's so good. It gives Odo so much to do, and it just the way it shades everything else, it's like, I'm willing to give it that. I think if like Enterprise or Voyager had done something similar or tried to do something similar, they would have completely wasted what you could do with a character in that situation. And it would be like, that is the most contrived, crappy coincidence that has ever been, yeah, you know, created. But it's nice, Rene Aubergemont says that, you know, initially when they told him, yeah, we're going to make the founders your species, so we're going to find out where you came from, and that's going to be the answer to it. And he was really resistant to it at first, because he kind of felt the same way J.J. Abrams feels about a lot of things. Like, no, it's better if the mystery stays the mystery, because the mystery is better than actually knowing what the answer to the puzzle is. But making it that answer and giving him, shifting his, you know, his thematically what he's about and giving him different difficulties to deal with, I think is a really great like pivot to go a different direction with it, but also to keep growing him and sending sending him off in new directions character-wise without, you know, okay, well, his through line has been, oh, where did he come from? Now we know where he is. Now we know where he comes from. So right. I guess we're done with Odo. No, they answered that question, but they used that answer as a launching pad to even better stuff, I think.
Right. They give him so much to do, and they turn him into such a more interesting character that even though it is a huge contrivance, you sort of go along with it. You know, not to get into Battlestar spoilers, but I think that's part of the problem with where that show went is people said, this isn't doing enough, you know, making these huge revelations about the characters isn't making the show more interesting. It's just saying, oh, isn't that crazy? You never would have guessed that. So you can't buy into it. This is just as ridiculous, but because it's such a good thing for the character, you just go with it and say, I want to see where this goes.
Yeah, I think the problem with Battlestar was that all of the crazy character stuff that they pulled never really had any lasting consequences to it. So Apollo would do something in one episode that was this crazy big reveal, and I can't believe Apollo did this or didn't do that or wants to do this. But then that would just kind of drop by a week or two later. And that kind of kept happening with Battlestar, I think, a lot of times. But what's great about, and I think as you get towards the end, you know, Odo, I don't think Odo's character sticks a perfect landing, but the episode where the Dominion has occupied the station and Odo and Kira are still on it, and Odo is spending all the time with the female founder, and Kira finally has to like slap him around and go, "What the hell are you doing? What's wrong with you?" And it's not a perfect good. Odo is not being a perfect good guy in that moment. He's not like, "Oh, you know, I'm sleeping with her to get the information to secretly help the rebellion." No, he's genuinely just lost his bearings.
Yeah,
and he's genuinely in a morally gray area that then Kira has to pull him out, and that's a real consequence to, you know, that's a great morally gray payoff to the setup that the search establishes.
And that's a podcast issue by itself. Just Odo sleeping with a female changeling and how freaking creepy that was.
How exactly that works.
speaking of Battlestar, this episode was the introduction, Ronald D. Moore's introduction to DS9. Mm-hmm. And you can definitely tell that the tonality change from this episode on, and his presence, his verve, and his influence on the show. And I think that's why, I mean, they couldn't have picked a better time to bring Moore in after TNG to really, you know, headline this massive story arc that's going to define the rest of the series. Because I really like Ronald D. Moore in Deep Space Nine, and I didn't like Ronald D. Moore in Battlestar Galactica because I felt like in DS9, Moore had a leash, like people to kind of keep him grounded. And I like Moore when he has constraints because I feel like he can be more creative. But with Battlestar, I felt like he was just let run free and ran certain aspects into the ground.
Yeah, I think, and this is my speculation, but I think that Ronald D. Moore has a great flair for, and then this happens, and it blows everybody's minds. And that's a really great quality to have as a showrunner, as a storyteller, as a writer. But you need to either, or you need somebody else in the room who can say, okay, that happens, so therefore, this is what the consequences of that happening are. And therefore, this is the fallout that we then have to deal with and we have to focus on. And so I don't know what the writer's room of DS9 is like, but I kind of suspect, you know, Ronald D. Moore was like that. And then maybe it was Ira Stephen Baer who's saying, okay, awesome. And then, you know, let's deal with the fallout of that and the morally gray stuff of that. Whereas on Battlestar, you know, maybe there wasn't somebody necessarily to do that.
I don't know if you heard the podcast where Moore basically put a recorder in there during the writer's room while they were breaking a couple episodes. And you hear them come up with these huge story-changing events where it's just like someone saying, hey, what if this happened? And then Moore's like, that's a great idea. That probably means that all this other stuff needs to completely change. But no, that sounds cool. Let's do that.
Let's screw it. Yeah.
Let's do it.
That kind of free-form, free-flowingness that is good on one level of being a writer, but on another level you need to deal with those freeform ideas and, you know, actually wrap that stuff up in a coherent way.
It's funny because when you look at the main shows that Ron Moore has been involved with, you can tell the differences in the writing room, like what we're speculating right now. Like, you know, in with DS9, you know, he kind of had a grounding figure through Iyer Steven Behr. With Battlestar Galactica, free reign, just, you know, throw a dart on the wall and say, oh yeah, that'd be cool, let's change everything. And then, like, the 2 weeks that he spent at Voyager, you know, where Brandon Braga was just like, no, I'm gonna nail you down to the floor so you can't do a thing. And then he's like, well, that's why he left. And it's just funny, like, which ones he thrives in, and which one where he thrives in, and which one where the show thrives.
Well, I think the breaking point was when he told Brandon Braga that Chakotay was actually a Cylon. And Braga said, look, we just can't go that route on this show. So
creative differences.
Gotta let you go. Right. All this comes down to the fact that we, going back to the end of season two with the Jem'Hadar and now into the Search, we see the birth of the Dominion. So on the Next Generation, I don't know. I was going to say that our big enemy on the Next Generation was the Borg, although the Borg don't appear that often on the Next Generation, but they're probably the most powerful enemy. Mm-hmm. You know, Q is kind of like an annoying little guy that comes around to harass Picard sometimes, right? But the Borg were the big enemy. So then on DS9, we don't really have anything up to this point. We have the, who are the guys, Greg, who in Move Along Home, who make you play Dungeons and Dragons. You know, there
are a lot of Dungeons and Dragons on this show.
Yeah, so they're not very scary. So now we get the Dominion being born. And what do you guys think about the Dominion? If you think about threatening enemies to the Federation, the Klingons, the Borg, the Dominion, where does the Dominion fall there for you? For me, the Dominion is probably the most menacing enemy that we've had on Star Trek, because they're not just on autopilot like the Borg are. They're actually have a scheme and a plan, and they're thinking behind what's going on.
It depends on, you know, how you define it. As a straight concept, I think the Borg are hands down the most terrifying and one of the most terrifying antagonistic forces in television. But in actual execution, the Borg start off amazing and then slowly turn into great big piles of crap, thanks to later seasons of TNG and
kind of like the reverse Voyager. Of the Ferengi.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So in pure concept, I think the Borg win, but in terms of consistent execution, I think the Dominion are better. Yeah, you know, they're not quite as awesome. They're not quite as high concept as the Borg are, but in terms of you know, the actual. Right. The actual menace and consequences and threat that they and story that they generate, quality storytelling that they generate, the Dominion win out over the Borg.
Well, like you said, the Borg are the most terrifying, but I think there's a difference between the terrifying and threatening as well. The Borg are terrifying because they're cold and mindless and seem unstoppable. It's like a horror movie, right? They're terrifying in that way, but in terms of being threatening to the very existence of the Federation.
Yeah.
I always felt the Dominion was more so, because the Borg, I mean, we defeat them every time we face them. We defeat them by putting them to sleep, or, you know, making them eat some bad apples, or I don't know, all the different methods that have been used.
Yeah, and well, that's the problem with the Borg is we face them about 20 times too often, and you know, as we talked about, if you beat the unstoppable villain too many times, then they're not an unstoppable villain, and then it's, you know, dramatically they're not interesting.
Yeah, I like what you had to say, Brian, about like exposing ourselves to the Borg too much, because with the Dominion, I mean, we spend more time on the Dominion than any other bad guy in Deep Space Nine, but yet it just gets more and more interesting. They peel off more layers, but they don't overuse them or expose them, you know. But with what Voyager did to the Borg, with being in the Delta Quadrant, they just kind of almost made the Borg, they literally made the Borg more human with Seven of Nine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they kind of did that to the character itself. They're like, okay, well, it's no longer mysterious, it's no longer frightening, and now they're introducing transphasic, you know, torpedoes take care of it in one hit, blah blah blah. And so, but with DS9, they just did it right. They showed us more of a bad guy, focused on it more, but all they did was make it more interesting and cooler. And I don't know exactly where the disconnect was between Voyager and Deep Space Nine, but those are two prime examples of how to do it and how not to do it.
I think it comes down to, if I had to guess, I would say that it comes down to the fact that even though we spend so much time with the Dominion, like you say, it's still all tied together into one overall story. Ultimately, you know, you can see, you know, even in any singular episode, you can see that that episode is a piece of one larger story. Whereas with the Borg, each episode or instance we encounter the Borg is more or less its own self-contained story. So instead of one big story with the Borg, we have 20 or 30 whatever smaller stories with the Borg, and we beat the Borg each time, you know, 20 or 30 right. times. As opposed to the Dominion, we do beat the Dominion, but we only beat the Dominion once. And the Dominion kicks right. our asses, you know, plenty of times within, you know, to earn that ultimate victory. As opposed to, you know, later TNG and Voyager, where it's like, yeah, each defeat is its own self-contained thing.
Yeah, we lose billions with the Dominion and just a few red shirts with the Borg.
Yeah.
I think a difference, I'd say, between the Dominion and the Borg are the way they're presented as far as their threat. The Dominion is the enemy at the gates, whereas the Borg was always this enemy that you sort of meet if you go out too far, you come across them. And occasionally, like, a ship finds its way near us. But the Dominion is this, really, it's a quadrant-wide empire. And we just accidentally poked open a hole between them and us. And they could just come in at any moment. And I think that just gives it this much greater sense of threat than I ever felt with the Borg, especially on Voyager, when, you know, what's the worst thing that's going to happen if they don't defeat the Borg? Voyager's going to get blown up and the series is going to end. That's not quite the same thing as the Federation being
wiped
destroyed or enslaved. Yeah.
Or maybe Harry Kim is going to get killed again.
Oh no, Harry Kim won't get laid.
So, the other thing about the Dominion, too, is that unlike the Borg, who are this overpowering force, the Dominion are pretty much technologically on par with the Federation. I mean, you have the Founders who have these kind of unusual powers, but they are always kind of in the background, you know, like just appearing. The worst they ever did was infiltrate Earth and, what, plant a bomb, I think, right at a meeting.
Right.
Of the council, whereas they can't just overwhelm you. And then you have the Vorta and the Jem'Hadar, and we're able to kind of fight them the way we would fight the Klingons or someone in the past. So that was able, each encounter is not like a life or death situation for the series, right? Maybe you use a ship, you know, like in the Jem'Hadar, the episode, the Jem'Hadar leading into this, we saw the Odyssey be destroyed, a Galaxy-class starship, which highlighted the major design flaw of the Galaxy-class starship, which is putting an enormous giant neck on it.
And that was a key decision, too, to pick the Galaxy-class, because it hits close to home.
Yeah.
You know, because of the Enterprise, you know.
I know we're not talking about that episode, but that's such a great moment and a great kick to the guts. Go, hey, remember that ship from the last show that you really, really loved? Boom! There it goes, and that's who we're dealing with, and that's a great setup of the real stakes that we're dealing with.
Yeah, it is a good point that showed the threat of the Dominion, right? That the Galaxy class starship could be so easily eliminated.
Yeah,
and I don't know how it was so easily eliminated with three runabouts. I mean, it had three runabouts on its side, but yet it still got destroyed. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how that's possible.
Well, you know, you can do a lot when you're willing to kamikaze yourself, but. It is not an accident that Captain Keogh looks so much like Picard. That was done on purpose to add to that effect.
Yeah, I'm sure they were very aware that Next Gen was going off the air at the same time that they were doing this. I guess we haven't said that The Search is the first of a series of episodes that actually aired when DS9 was the only Trek series on the air for about three or four months. And I really feel like they were trying to put out their own identity, and part of that was, let's blow up a Galaxy class ship, they hinted at making Sisko a captain. I guess it doesn't actually happen yet. That's still coming.
They tease it, but
start
of
season four.
It doesn't
start of season four.
Yeah, you know, and I think what it was
give them
when he shaved his head, trimming the sideburns doesn't quite get you to captain level yet, but
it does get you your own ship.
Right, and that's what I was going to say. They brought an actual starship that can move around, and open up the possibilities of the show a little bit more. I think that's a big part of establishing the show's identity, was bringing the Defiant on.
Oh, which, yeah, for sure. Which they say on Memory Alpha, you know, the producers claim that that was not a decision imposed on them by the network. I'm not sure how much I believe that personally, because yeah. Worf was something that was imposed on the network, and they were definitely right. struggling in the ratings, and it was like, well, you have to do something to get the ratings, and people are just bored with, you know, thinking that, right or wrong, people think that the show is boring because it's on a space station, so
right.
It's Star Trek, get back on a ship and go out there and trek a little bit.
And this thing will blow stuff up.
Yes.
There will be explosions.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, can we talk about that? Like I love the Defiant. It's fantastic. It is one of my favorite ships. I'm a big nerd when it comes to ships, because like growing up I would get the blueprints, I'd put them up all over my walls instead of, you know, pretty girls, you know, like I had blueprints on my walls. But I thought this was the introduction of the Defiant was amazing, but I didn't think that this was the episode to do it. I really felt like it should have been later on, like after they met the Dominion, because the Defiant got its butt kicked immediately.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like that really bothered me. Like they said, they're like, oh yeah, she has flaws, but she has teeth. You know, that's a fantastic quote, but we didn't get to see the teeth at all. Like it destroyed one ship, and then they
had to evacuate, had to abandon ship. Yeah. And it's like, it's still not very clear, you know, at the end of the episode or at the end of the two-parter, mm-hmm. you know, after they reveal that, oh, it's all a great big mind screw, and now we're going to let you go home. So, but you still had the ship, but you had to abandon ship. And you don't abandon ship if your ship is capable of still flying home.
Yeah.
So did they just let them get back on the Defiant, and did they repair? And it's the fact that we don't see any of that action at all. All we see is we get this great introduction. Oh, here's this ship that's, you know, a badass personified in ship form. Now let's go out and kick some ass. And it turns out to immediately get its own ass kicked. And then we don't see the resolution of that at all. It's just,
it was kind of like the next in the long history of starships that are sent out in Star Trek that aren't ready to go anywhere yet. Like we have in The Wrath of Khan, the Enterprise has a cadet training crew on it, right? And it has to go out on a mission. And then in Generations, the Enterprise B is not ready to go anywhere yet, because everything required to operate the ship is arriving on Tuesday.
And Star Trek 5 as well.
Star Trek 5, the ship is broken all the time.
The most ridiculous version of it. It was like it had a software problem. Like it was Microsoft Vista of Enterprises.
The paperclip kept the Enterprise coming. A. Would you like to fly a starship? No, go away.
Yeah,
I'll do it on my own.
Or it comes up on the screen. It looks like you're trying to repair the warp core.
Would you like me to help you? It looks like you're trying to fight Klingons. Would you like some help? No.
No. So, but that happens, often. And then here, the Defiant, there's some lines in there where I think Bashir goes to give Odo quarters and he says, well, most of the crew quarters don't have life supports yet. And like, what does that mean?
I don't know how that happens.
How does like part of the ship have life support, but some of the quarters don't have life support?
It only has 5 decks, too. I mean,
right. Yeah.
What, do they seal off the sections like, oh, there's no air in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's only
and
five
they should
decks,
put
so
Odo in there, right? Odo
for?
Doesn't need air. Put Odo in one of the quarters that doesn't need.
He just
needs
a bucket in a corner. It's not that difficult.
Put him in the janitor's closet.
That's exactly. I even said that out loud. I was by myself and I said it out loud. I was like, just put him in the janitor's closet. That's all he needs, you know.
Oh, but so I guess going back to what started this little discussion about whether the Defiant was imposed by the studio or.
Yeah.
The writers came up with it. And the timing, like Tristan, you said, the timing of when the Defiant appeared on the show kind of suggests that it was a case that the studio is saying, look, stationary, the Next Generation's off the air. Now all we have is a show set on a space station. The fans don't like it being stationary, which I don't know if that's really true or not, but that's what's always been said. You know, I never felt that way personally. It didn't bother me. But it's kind of like, okay, here's the new season. We're going to have a new ship where we can go places. And that's like one of the first reveals in the episode. I think it actually is the very first thing that happens, right?
Yeah, it's the
Defiant decloaks. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I feel like a lot of fair weather Star Trek fans didn't like Deep Space Nine for that very reason. Like, when the show was actually on the air, I had a lot of people come to me once they found out that I was a Star Trek fan. They're like, do you watch Deep Space Nine? I say, yeah. And they say, isn't, like, I couldn't get into it. It's too boring. They're on a space station. They're not going anywhere. It's not fun. And, you know, I try to convince them. I was like, no, it's amazing. You know, all this stuff comes to them. And then they venture out to explore more. And I found out that Deep Space Nine is probably the Star Trek series that people didn't watch on the air, but then rediscovered with the DVDs or with Netflix and just went, wow, this is really amazing, because it's one of those season-long, series-long arcs that you can enjoy once you can watch it rapid fire instead of week after week after week after week.
Yeah. Yeah, I can agree. I can see how some fans feel that way. For me, I think it gave them an opportunity to make the storytelling in terms of the characters more interesting, because the characters were forced to interact with each other more so instead of just interacting with, you know, the alien of the week, which we often got. But, you know, another big thing about the Defiant was that this was the first Federation ship with a cloaking device, which brought about a kind of an interesting thing here that I'm very glad they didn't stick with. And this was the fact that they got the cloak from the Romulans, and apparently it could only be operated by a Romulan officer who had to be stationed to the Defiant. And not only that, but no one else was allowed to press any buttons related to the cloak.
Right.
Which I personally like that aspect. They completely drop it. And from a storytelling standpoint, from a writer standpoint, I understand why, because they were like, well, what else are we going to have her do week after week other than push the button? But I like, and that makes sense to me. It makes sense that the Romulans would go, okay, this is a really low risk, low cost way for us to get information and have our nose in this without risking anything ourselves. But also, here's a way to cover our bases. You know, from a real world kind of political perspective, that makes sense to me. But they didn't really flesh it out once they realized, we have nothing to do with this character. But I feel like
maybe she was a spy too, because this is the other thing I thought. Because so the Romulans get her on there as a spy, and it worked out great, because I was thinking that, why is Seska on the Defiant? Because we all thought that Seska was a Bajoran, and then she turned out to be a Cardassian, when actually, apparently, she was a Romulan.
In season 5 of DS9, it was going to turn out that she was half Vulcan, and that was going to be a big surprise for everyone.
It's amazing when they use these actors and actresses over and over and over and over, right, in Star Trek.
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, Martha Hackett played the Romulan here.
Yeah, I think I liked the idea of her being there initially, but she definitely would have become a less attractive Gwyn Madison, like from Galaxy Quest, where she just has one thing and one thing only.
Yes, exactly.
And I was happy that the producers and writers kind of wrote her off, and because I don't like Martha Hackett. I mean, I kind of was okay with her being Seska, but that's because I like the character. But yeah, no, I was happy with her being gone, because, like everybody's saying, she's hitting a button and she's annoying. So,
and I also found it strange to have a Romulan officer paging Sisko over the system, over the ship con, right? Like, bridge to Sisko, and it's this Romulan commander.
I don't know. I guess I'm more with Brian on this, that I kind of like the idea of having a Romulan there. It's the issue that she only really had one thing to do. But remember, this was the first time we see the Romulans in DS9. So it's finally broadening that and bringing in some of the more familiar elements of Star Trek. And it's the idea that the Alpha Quadrant is banding together, you know, a little bit. You know, there's still tension, but they're recognizing that there is this big threat, and maybe we need to work together a little bit more. Now, I don't know what they could have done with their character, but then I didn't know what they're possibly going to do with Worf, bring him on DS9. He was such a part of Next Gen, but they found plenty of new and interesting things to do with him, and many characters, you know, Garak, you know. So I think she could have been interesting had they decided to go in that direction. I'm kind of ambivalent. I didn't want her to go, but I didn't see what they could have done with her, but I would have liked to see them figure it out and not just drop her.
Yeah, I agree. Even though I'm with Tristan in the sense that I don't really enjoy Martha Hackett as an actress. I'm sure she's a perfectly fine lady in real life, but when she's on screen, I just want to go find something else to do. But the idea of a Romulan just kind of being there and having their foot in everything, and you know, if she's in the room, can we talk openly, or you know, exactly. Do we have to? I feel like had they tried a little harder, they could have found some interesting ways to go, and they just like decided they didn't want to, which is a shame definitely. Because like, I don't think I was here for the Romulan episode, but the Romulans are such a great construct, but they've gotten such a short shrift in the Star Trek canon for the most part. You know, Nemesis is terrible, and most of Voyager is terrible. But when Deep Space Nine does the Romulans, on the few occasions that it does it, they do them really well. And I wish we had spent more time with the Deep Space Nine writers doing the Romulans.
And there was plenty of opportunities for them in Deep Space Nine because of the Alliance and because of situations, you know, in the Pale Moonlight-esque. But we just mm-hmm. kind of didn't go there. I mean, I feel like I think Deep Space Nine felt like they had to focus on one race in the Alpha Quadrant, and that was pretty much the Klingons. They're like, okay, we have a Klingon officer on board now, so we're just gonna talk about the Klingons. So maybe if they kept Martha Hackett's character, they would have focused more on the Romulans. But because Worf came on and she left, I feel like that's what happened, and I'm okay with that.
But how great would it have been had she stuck around, and then Worf comes on a season later, and then you have two main characters who really, really despise each other on a pure racist level. You have two characters that are actively and openly racist about each other. I think that would have been a really interesting dynamic, and I think it's a shame that it didn't
even think about that.
And then they end up getting married in season 6.
And then we have 22 characters to focus on instead of 21.
That's right.
Well, I mean, you were talking about the Dominion being a really interesting enemy, and they're a lot more like the Romulans than they are like the Borg or the Klingons. They're much more that devious enemy that we've always been talking about. And political enemies and enemies that are on the same technological level as us and on the same mental level as us. And so in that aspect, they are a real threat. So, yes, I wish we had at some point done one of those big Romulan war episodes or seasons or series, but it is good to see that they're finally getting to that, showing the devious sort of enemy, the person who pretends to be your friend and then stabs you in the back a moment later.
Yeah,
it's a much more interesting enemy than a lot of the enemies we saw on Next Gen.
Yeah, Wayun is a great, and Dukat for that matter, is, you know, the man that you can look at, you know, straight in the eye across the room, and he's smiling broadly at you, but you know as soon as you turn your back, his knife is going in your back. But as long as you're, you know, shaking his hands, he's perfectly charming and perfectly, you know, sociable. That's always one of the most interesting villains and one of the most interesting dynamics to have in drama and, you know, in storytelling or television. And that's what I think the Romulans can be great at, and what I think DS9 did very well with Dukat and Wayun and a lot of others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can we talk about how absurd it is that Julian Bashir beat up a Jim Hadar? Can we talk about that?
Let's talk about that. Okay, so Julian Bashir,
yes,
takes on the Jim Hadar. All right,
isn't he? Enhanced. He's like genetically enhanced.
I knew someone.
But we don't know that.
I knew somebody was going to say no. He can do whatever he wants. He's genetically enhanced. Okay, let's put this in perspective, though. The writers, the fight choreographer, the producers, whatever. They're like, no, Jim Hadar. You know, people who are bred to fight coming on to. They're going to come onto the bridge, and Julian is going to give them what for. All of those, you know, holosuite, you know, simulations are going to, you know, going to help him to beat this guy up. And it was just like watching Kira beat up a Klingon, not just beat up a Klingon, but throw him across the room.
Well, actually, I can buy more Kira beating up a Klingon than Bashir beating
up
a Jim Hadar.
That's true. I can buy more.
Yeah, because Kira was, you know, a freedom fighter. She was a terrorist for her entire life.
Yeah, but she's still a 120-pound terrorist. That's what I'm saying. You know?
That's yeah, true. But she's and she tough. Doesn't I have five hearts writers... and seven kidneys the way Klingon
exactly.
does.
And right. two spines.
I think the writers are used to having Riker, Worf, and Data on the bridge, who can pretty much beat up anybody at all. And they've kind of forgot to write characters like that for the show that can beat up people. So you end up having to have Julian do a karate chop on a Jem'Hadar's back. And it visually, like, it's a little...
Well, let's just be honest and say that the stunt and fight choreography, more specifically, the fight choreography of Star Trek has never been spectacular.
What are you talking about? They invented the original series. The two-fist punch.
The two-fisted back punch thing, and then Shatner's donkey kick.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of great things about Star Trek. Right. Its fight choreography is not one.
When I was in high school, that saved me several times. Yeah.
At this point, they have to realize that instead of Worf, Riker, and Data, you know, they have Bashir, Rom, and Molly O'Brien, right, on the bridge.
Yeah.
Right. But when I see Molly do a karate chop in someone's back and knock them out, then I'm just definitely, they've jumped the shark there.
But you make a good point, and I think it's a larger problem in Star Trek in the sense that whatever your main character happens to be at that moment can beat up whoever they need to beat up in order to be the badass. And it's like, okay, so let's think about this for a second. First of all, out of the universe, the writers didn't know that Julian Bashir was genetically modified at this point. Right. So that's not even an issue. But let's even be gracious and say in the universe, he's still genetically modified. Or let's say genetically enhanced is the better term for it. Genetically enhanced versus created genetically specifically for the purpose of. That's what he's fighting. A genetically enhanced, which say he's a 5, takes him to a 6 versus the guy who was built from scratch to be a 10. Like, it still doesn't add up.
Well, plus Bashir he's mentally enhanced, right? And maybe his ability to survive harsh conditions or something might be advanced, but he's not genetically enhanced, like you're saying, Brian, to be a fighter. His physical strength is not, as I understood anyway.
Okay. Yeah, well, his parents programmed him to pass med school. They didn't program him to...
Yeah, that was that was part of the extra deluxe package that they couldn't afford.
Yeah,
That was option C.
I don't think he was strong like Khan. I mean, I think he just had the brains like Khan.
Right.
I mean, I should be devil's advocate for a moment and remind everyone that I think the Jem'Hadar weren't really there to put the beatdown on them, that there was a plan in place here. And I think the Jem'Hadar might have been told, go a little easy on these guys. You know, especially they let Odo and Kira get away so they can go to the Nebula. I think that Jem'Hadar might have been letting Bashir beat them up.
That's a really valid point.
Well, not only that, honestly. In the episode The Jem'Hadar, they also let Sisko and Quark escape to get back to the station and the Vorta came back. Mm-hmm. So like you're saying, Greg, I think at this point they're just trying to make a point to the Federation that they are there and that they should be frightened of them. So
wouldn't it be amazing
someone has to take a fall?
If you could tell by the fight choreography that that's what was happening. Wouldn't it be amazing if the fight choreography wasn't exactly the same every single time and you could tell, this is actually different than... The last episode where the Jem'Hadar really did kick some ass, you can tell that he's doing something different.
Like two Jem'Hadar, they give each other a knowing look, and then one of them gets kicked in the face by Bashir, and then a couple of the other ones crack up in the background. Then you would know for sure what's going on. I also think at this point, too, that the Jem'Hadar that we know from all through the Dominion War is these like incredible fighters weren't quite developed yet at this point either. The Jem'Hadar... At this point, they're just kind of the alien. They're working. They're like the henchmen of the Vorta, and they haven't been created in the mold of these unstoppable fighters yet that we see later on when they're addicted to the Ketracel white drug and all this stuff.
Yeah, well,
I mean, they're just the gangsters
Klingon.
that get sent in to beat you up if you don't. Pay the whatever you pay to the mafia. They come
the
in break your legs.
Yeah, they're more generic foot soldiers versus Gamma Quadrant Klingons that they eventually become.
Right.
Well, talking about some other characters in here, we have some character development a little bit anyway. I think for Sisko and for Dax as well. We see Dax's past lives coming, especially the Curzon relationship with Sisko coming out a little bit.
I love how Dax calls Sisko Benjamin. Yeah. Like, Not just Ben, but Benjamin.
She should have called him Benji, though. That would have been even cooler. Benji.
Benny. That would have been. No, I mean, it's obvious insubordination, but he accepts it. Like, he immediately accepted their relationship. And it's one of my favorite relationships in the show. You know, we always talked about Spock, McCoy, and Kirk as being that great triumvirate of TOS. And I don't know, I'm still not familiar enough with DS9 to tell you what the greatest relationships of DS9 were, but I love every scene that every quiet scene Sisko has with Dax. Like, there was one where they were just having dinner in this episode, and they were just talking honestly, like people who had known each other for decades, and she was giving him advice. And one reason I wanted to bring this up was she was giving him advice as Curzon, like reminding him Curzon would have said this, but also giving him advice as Jadzia.
Yeah.
So it's like Sisko has two or more friends in one, and she's just this really fantastic character.
No, I really like the idea that they've set up, in the sense that you have this person who used to be a different person, but you know, this third person, Sisko, it has a relationship with both of them, and it's a very interesting relationship that I don't think I've ever seen elsewhere in science fiction, at least in that exact flavor. And I think it allowed them to do some really interesting things and have some interesting scenes like the one you were just talking about. So
yeah,
that's definitely, I think, one of my favorite relationships in the franchise. Yeah.
I think Picard and Guinan and Janeway and Tuvok had, or at least were supposed to have, similar relationships, although they never delved into them quite as deeply.
Yeah, they had known each other for a very long time.
Quite the justification behind them that I think Dax and Sisko have.
Right.
Yeah, certainly.
I think that is one of the examples of we were talking about where, like, you may like the character more than the actor or actress. I you guys, I really enjoy the relationship between the two of them. I like that she called him Benjamin. I really like that he called her old man. I thought that was hysterical and awesome at the same time. But I just wish that Terry Farrell could play older better. I never once believed that she held seven lifetimes of experiences in her. I felt like she was a 20-something actress who was just instructed to say, yeah, Curzon would have said this, but I never believed that she had Curzon's memories. I felt like she had Curzon's journals and not, you know, his actual existence.
Yeah.
I guess I feel the same way, but I'm willing to go with it, to give her the leeway, because she's so hot. that's pretty much the leeway.
Well, not just that, I was listening to this episode, just listening to the audio, but the way that Terry Farrell delivers Dax's lines, it's very, I guess I agree with you, Tristan, that you don't get that feeling that like she's seven lifetimes wise in what she's saying, but there's something so calm and natural about the way she delivers her lines and when she talks to Sisko that it works okay for me. It feels more than just a 20-year-old lieutenant who, you know, 20-something lieutenant who's getting her feet wet out in the deep space.
Yeah, that'd be Ezri.
It works okay for me, but I do know what you mean anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. I am with Chris that I feel like the way she had that calm delivery really sold it on it for me. I mean, she doesn't come across like Hoshi, who is very young on Enterprise very inexperienced. I feel like I can see the inexperience in Jadzia. I mean, then you have to remember that the way the symbiotes work is you don't necessarily gain the full, I mean, the way you put it, where she has Curzon's journals is almost a proper metaphor for what Jadzia has, because the Jadzia Dax is so much Jadzia and only partially Dax and only partially those previous lifetimes.
Yeah.
So she's almost simply drawing on it while still having to deal with her own inexperience.
And I think I think it was smart of them to set up the justification that way, because it then you can have a 20-something actress say these lines and still seem like a 20-something actress, but you can still get away with the effect they're trying to achieve, because it's still coming out of Jadzia. You know, it's Curzon's inside there somewhere, but it's still Jadzia on top.
It's all being filtered through Jadzia.
Right? Yeah. Because then Brian's
one question I have.
However you want to see.
What's Brian's fantasy?
Then, you know, if she was that good of an actress, Brian's fantasy would be shattered because she looks like a hot 20-something pinup but talks like his grandma. So no one would want that.
Right. Or worse, my grandfather.
It was like those episodes of Fringe where Olivia was possessed by William Bell, Leonard Nimoy, and she's doing that terror. Have you guys seen Fringe?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
This beautiful young actress is doing an impression of Leonard Nimoy for like 3 or 4 episodes because she's possessed by him. Oh, it is the most horrible thing of all time.
It was funny because I read some articles where like people were like Entertainment Weekly was praising her. Well, that's all that Entertainment Weekly does anyway. But they're praising her for not doing like a literal interpretation of Leonard Nimoy's voice, but just doing her own old man voice. I was like, really? Okay, fine. Let's just go with it. She was talking I'm William Bell, but I look like a hot blonde.
I'm not completely proud of... I think I would be pretty turned on by a beautiful woman acting like Leonard Nimoy. I'm not sure how proud of that I am.
This is the podcast of reveals right now.
That would be fairly attractive to me.
We're learning so much.
Boy, there's a lot coming out in this episode of the Ready
Maybe that's
Room.
What you should call this episode. And one coming thing, out.
And one other thing I know from this is that Brian will never be able to watch Deep Space Nine the same way again.
Yeah,
he's always going to see his grandma through Dax's lines.
He's coming out of a turbo lift.
Now, one other question I have about the whole Trill symbiote thing is that do Trills inherit the hairstyles of all of their past hosts?
Yes, all at once. So that's 8 lifetimes worth of hair right there.
Because I don't know what's going on in this episode, but in the very opening of the search, when they cut to Dax and I see that hair, I was like, what is going on? That's where
the memories are stored, in the bun. That's where all the symbiote memories are stored.
Oh, is that it?
So that's why it needs to be so large.
Were they doing makeup tests for Janeway? I know they have the caretaker pilot coming up, and maybe they were trying to figure out, you know, can we put an actress in a wig that looks ridiculous and still have the audience watch the show?
Right. An inverse bun, I think, is what it
Absolutely.
Was.
Yeah, maybe they just had one hairstylist for that week. I was doing both shows, and they didn't have that hairstylist for very long, I hope.
What was like, do you know, on the Jem'Hadar ships, they have like these really, you know, they glow purple and they have like these grooves going around the bottom.
Yeah, I love that.
Jadzia had those grooves going down both sides of her head. It was kind of like patterns on a warp nacelle or something going down. So it looked like they used like a whole bucket full of, maybe it was the bucket that Odo sleeps in, I don't know, a whole bucket full of gel to hold that stuff in place, but I'm glad they didn't stick
it was
that
only
anyway.
It was only this episode, and I think it was because either like the fans reacted to it or people like the writers' spouses were just like, what were you thinking, you know, doing that?
I have to live with this person. No, I will not take this haircut. Right.
I mean, they redid Odo's look, his wardrobe, and I thought that came across really well. I liked his new look, and I'm glad they stuck with that. They didn't do many changes like that going in. It was mainly just Jadzia and Odo, I think.
Yeah, Odo had been evolving from the beginning of the series, including his facial makeup as well, had been evolving a lot. And he, you notice with Odo that from the beginning of the series, he looks a lot skinnier, a lot like a scrawny character than he does by this point. At this point, he actually looks more fleshed out.
One thing I really love about these episodes is the way part 2 just really pulls one over on the audience, where at the end you realize that the B story with Odo and Kira on the Founder's planet was actually the A story all along, and that our main characters have been in what I termed a Founder D&D game the entire show. It's one of those episodes where you watch the whole thing, and when you watch it for the first time, you're thinking, you know, this isn't right, but maybe this is just the direction the show's going. Maybe I might buy it. Do you remember the first time you saw it? Were you buying what they were selling?
Like you felt that Well, yeah, the first thing that struck me was when Sisko and Bashir, is that right? Sisko and mm-hmm. Bashir are in the right. shuttle mm-hmm. and O'Brien and Dax come in through the hatch. And when they say that there are big things happening at the station, you'll want to get back as soon as possible. I thought, wait, what do you mean big things are happening? There's been very little time, right? They just abandoned ship. Maybe they've been searching for them for days or something, but not much time has happened. And that was a bit odd. And then the idea that the Federation had already had some diplomatic meeting with the Dominion was a bit odd.
Yeah, and signing a treaty that fast. I mean, they spent almost a decade trying to get Bajor into the Federation. I doubt that they're going to sign a treaty within a couple of days. Yeah, that was like, I thought something was fishy at that point when I first saw the episode, but I really knew, I was like, okay, they're going to hit the reset button when Garak died, because
right.
Like, he wasn't as big of a character as he's going to become in the next couple of seasons, but at that same time, his death would have been a lot bigger and focused on more if he did actually die in real life. So that's when I was like, oh, okay, well, there we go. All right. And Voyager took a turn from that.
DS9 is great, but Game of Thrones, it's not. So, you know, when a major or even a major secondary character goes down, you go, oh, okay, something is definitely up here.
Yeah, right.
But Garrick's death comes late enough where I think if your alarm bells were going to go off, they would have gone off by that point. Right. So if they haven't at that point, they definitely do then. Yep. And then it's not that much longer before they give you the punchline anyway. So I remember, I have the vague feeling of remembering, like, okay, something is definitely up, but I don't know what it is. And then, of course,
right,
they went to the tried and true Deus Ex Machina. It was all a simulation. It was all a holodeck
right.
thing, and none of it. Right. It was all a dream sequence, basically.
And Necheyev,
right? Dax walked out of the shower.
And Necheyev was extra cold hearted this episode.
That's a great aspect to fake out for the fans of, like, bringing in this already established, you know, recurring character that you've seen before, but not in this context, from an entirely different context, mm-hmm. lends it a sense of reality that you go, oh, okay, this is, it's good storytelling in the sense that, okay, here's this universe, this fictional universe that we created has corners to it, and here's, you know, another corner walking into our corner for an episode. And
yeah, they didn't just send in a random
fake out. It's great.
Yeah. They didn't just send in a random starship captain this time. They actually sent in a bigwig vice admiral that we have known
that we've seen before. Right. Yeah. And that, so it's like, oh, I know who she is. I remember her from the other thing. And that subconsciously that does something and tell you, okay, this is for real. This is more than just, you know, random admiral guy on the monitor for, you know, of the week. And so it contributes to that fake out.
And they finally decided on a design for the admiral uniform at this point.
Oh, I know.
Oh, yes, right. Very nice.
On the 47th try.
Oh, my gosh.
Right?
Yeah.
I liked that the Dominion sort of played their hand as far as the Romulans were concerned. They sort of revealed right here and there that they're kind of afraid of the Romulans. That they, even if they were to do a... Even if they were going to pretend to do a treaty with the Federation, they're going to stay away from the Romulans. They're going to keep them from getting involved.
Well, maybe. Or maybe they were trying to see if they could split the Federation and the Romulans apart. Because mm-hmm. later, you know, the Federation has to bring the Romulans into the war. Maybe they were trying to find out from, you know, the minds of the Starfleet captain there in the simulation, if they proposed leaving out the Romulans but bringing in other powers in the quadrant, would the Federation go along with that or not?
Yeah, I think that's a good point because I think, you know, they're like, okay, yeah, we can beat the Federation. We can beat the Klingons. We can beat the Romulans. We can maybe even beat the Klingons and the Federation, but we can't beat all three. We can't, you know, we can't defeat that trinity in the Alpha Quadrant. And I think, yeah, that was a definite tester to see if they could get them to ignore them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was great to see that the Romulan that we see for two episodes, I keep forgetting her name, it's T'Pol or T'Rol or
T'Rol or something.
T'Rol.
Yeah.
Yeah.
T'Rul is what I keep thinking every time I hear her name. I like how she's like really against this. She's like, you know, if you're going to do a treaty, I'd better be a part of this. And that does show her, as we were saying before, she's kind of not a hardline Romulan, because what the Romulans end up doing is just sort of doing a backroom deal with the Dominion. You know, you stay away from me, I'll stay away from you, this will be fine. I feel like she, had she stayed on with the show, would have been against that and would have been saying, look, we need to do some honest dealings and we need to be doing more with the Federation. This is sort of, this is a direction they didn't quite go in with the show as far as showing them really teaming up with the Romulans. But yeah, I do think it's interesting to show that the Dominion was scared of us on some level, you know, even while they were doing, you know, sort of playing with our main characters and just doing whatever they wanted. They knew that actually attacking the Federation straight on would be a difficult choice to make at best.
Yeah, definitely so. So final thoughts on this episode, guys, the search for Shur, and I kind of even include the Jem'Hadar in it because it is a three-part story, which is not the first time DS9 did a three-part story, but one of the things that this showed us was that that was the direction that the series was going in, these long multi-part stories here. And the way that it set up the Dominion, character development for Sisko, for Dax, for Odo, for the introduction to the Defiant, and then the whole reveal at the end of the Founders being Odo's people. Any final thoughts on this that we haven't already talked about?
Oh, you forgot about the introduction of the new comm badge. Probably the most important introduction in this season.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how
I don't know either.
I had a theory for a long time before that what the failing of Voyager, and this is a theory I had when I was younger, the failing of Voyager is that they basically never grew the beard in the sense that they never changed the uniform. Because Next Generation goes, you know, finally grows into its own in season 3 and they change the uniform. And I think this is the moment where Deep Space Nine really grows into its own and becomes the best that it's going to be. And they change. Right now it's just the comm badge, but then shortly after they change into the First Contact uniforms. And then the show really blossoms, you know, in that same time. And Voyager never really had that same instance. And for a while, I felt like that was linked, too. If they'd just gotten to, you know, if they'd done that point where they found their groove and they, you know, they visualized that, or they made that, they acted on that in the sense of changing the uniform, the production design in that regard, then somehow that would have an effect, and it never did. But I think in Deep Space Nine terms, the changing of the comm badge and then shortly after changing the uniform serves as like, this is the moment where it's like, you can look at the episode, if you see Sisko, and he's got hair and he's got the Next Generation comm badge, you know you're too early. If he still has right. hair, but he's got the Generations comm badge, okay, you're kind of in the right ballpark.
Hang around for a while. Contact, right?
Yeah, but you're wrong, Brian. You missed something. I mean, they did change the uniform. They got skin tight cat suits, for Voyager. Didn't you miss? Oh wait, they only did it for one character, but that's when people think that they hit their stride. So
thank goodness. Yeah. Imagine Chakotay was wearing that.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind if Chakotay was wearing it.
No one wanted
to
see
Neelix
Robert Beltran in the skin-tight catsuit.
Neelix. I'm surprised that the Doctor never did that just for fun, because for him it would have just been an easy thing to dial up that catsuit.
See, I thought it would have been this is going to be the uniform thing, and talking about Voyager, but I thought it would have been a nice, just a pure character moments where the crew of Voyager, they're still lost from home, but they've just made contact, you know, a message in a bottle, and the Doctor comes back and says, yeah, so this, and I did this, and oh yeah, by the way, the uniforms changed, they look like this now. And Janeway or the crew or whoever go, you know what, we're still cut off from home, we're still, you know, decades away from getting back to our loved ones, but by golly, we're still Starfleet officers, so we're changing uniforms. And I think that would have been that has nothing to do with Deep Space Nine, but I think that would have been a really nice character moment that
they would get some detail wrong though, and they were like the jackets would look normal, but they'd have like white Bermuda shorts on.
Or maybe the comm badges are slightly different and they get that wrong or something. Yeah. I don't know. But I thought that would have been a nice moment that they never because Voyager was not in any way, shape, or form about characters.
That would have been the valid moment when they could have done it and it would have made some kind of sense.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I think it was a resource issue.
It was, but I mean, but that also would have been a nice character moment where they said, oh, well, we don't really have the replicator rations to spare to do this and do this other thing we've wanted to be doing for, you know, that we established at the beginning of the episode. Okay, screw that luxury thing that we've been talking about all episode. We're going to do the uniforms instead. Yeah. Whatever it was. But
yeah, anyway, probably,
it would have been good.
Somebody give me a TV show, damn it. Anyway.
Tristan, final thoughts.
Oh, yeah. You know, I really like this episode. It's not exactly one that I go and rewatch a lot because I feel like this was like I really like arcs in Deep Space Nine. I felt like some of this stuff was stretched, like the Odo and Kira stuff were definitely stretched for time. I felt like that could have been condensed. But I do like this because of the introductions. We got the Defiant, we got the Founders, we got Odo's relationship to the Founders, we got the cloaking device, we get so many different introductions in here, and I really feel like this is the beginning of what DS9 is. And so this gets a 4 out of 5 stars from me.
Nice. I guess I had a weird reaction to the show that we haven't really gotten into, and that's at the start of the first episode. There's a lot of, I guess they're coincidences, a lot of things that just feel forced happen. It's the Starfleet bringing Eddington on and sort of demoting Odo, Sisko deciding to bring Quark on the trip, the Defiant in general showing up and having a cloaking device and a Romulan attached. There were a lot of things that happened that seemed to only be there so that the story that they wanted could happen, but they didn't feel like they flowed from anything that had come before. And I guess by the end of it, I'm fine with it because it ended up being a good episode. But right at the start, it's a bunch of scenes that are just like, why are they doing this particular thing? It seems like there's an easier way to do this, or one that just makes more sense from a character perspective.
Yeah, I think, like you said, a lot of it was set up so that the story that they wanted to happen could happen. You know, obviously, the bit about possibly replacing Odo was to foster his, when he finds his people, to put him in more conflict than he already was about whether he should stay or go. But and some of there was the discussion between Sisko and Kira, I believe, about Kira asking Sisko, how can you let them come in and replace Odo? And and Sisko kind of goes off on, you know, Odo, he's not a team player and he doesn't follow orders and he just does things when he wants with his reports. And that felt to me like a little bit out of the blue. Like I didn't feel that Sisko had those feelings about Odo in the past. And so that was kind of being.
Well, I don't think Sisko had those feelings too much. I know he says that he's like, yeah, I kind of agree with him. But I feel like he was kind of trying to say, hey, this is above my head, you know, like I understand where they're coming from, but I don't know. That was just my opinion.
Yeah. I, from that scene, I got the sense that Sisko was telling Kira, look, I fought the good fight. I stood up for him. But at the end of the day, there's only so much I can do. And these are the orders I've been given. So these are the orders I'm going to follow. That's the sense I got from that.
I guess I feel like this is still DS9 finding its sea legs as far as being a serialized show goes. Like, if they'd really, if this had been season 5 or 6, they would have spent 4 or 5 episodes really setting up the threads that would lead to this episode.
Yeah, right.
Whereas now they're kind of doing it jerkily. They're saying, here's these things, and now here's the story. And they're important things. They're things they don't drop, really. But They didn't have the sense later on where they felt like they could draw out these storylines and really get into them in a detailed manner over several episodes. Yeah. And I love the show when it gets to that point. And this is still to me a transitional episode, as great as it is.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's these things, they don't detract from the episode really for me, but they are not handled as smoothly as they would have been later on in the series for sure. All right, well, let's wrap up our discussion of the Search and the birth of the Dominion and all this today. And before we go, Brian, tell everyone where they can find you around the web.
Sure. You can find me on Twitter at Brian Finifter, B-R-I-A-N-F-I-N-I-F-T-E-R. And then I'm also a co-host on a podcast called Down in Front, where we we sit down and we watch movies and we record our own podcast, our own commentaries to them. So like the way a DVD has a director's commentary, it's like that, except instead of the director, it's us. But we have really great conversations. They're somewhere between a director's commentary and Mystery Science Theater 3000, depending on the movie. We try to break down movies and specifically their stories and try to figure out if they work, why do they work, and if they don't, why they don't work. And if it's a really bad movie, then we just make fun of it. and not quite a Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of way, but in our own sort of way. And you can, that's called Down in Front, and you can find us at downinfront.net. We also have a really great forum. If you check out the show and you like the show, I also recommend you check out our forums because we have really great discussions there, which you can also find through our website. And yeah, that's it.
Okay, excellent. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes too, so everyone can jump over. And also the quiz of how to spell your last name.
Yes. I was just getting grilled at that about work because my editor, my boss, was saying like, okay, so how do you pronounce it? And the argument was like, is it Finifter or Finifter? And where the emphasis goes. And I was like, I say it either way. It doesn't really matter. And he's like, no, it has to be a certain way. Which way is it? And I was like, I don't know. I'm just happy when people get the letters right. I don't care about emphasis.
Oh, man. All right. Well, Tristan, tell everyone where they can find you as well.
Oh, you can find me at Twitter at The Insane Robin. And I got a Tumblr under that name. And you can, of course, find me on the Hyper Channel. At Trek.fm, and also I'm starting a podcast of my own called 10 Forward. And any of you out there who are listening, what the show is, it's where I pretty much just sit down with you, you know, virtually of course, and interview average Star Trek fans, you know, just run of the mill everyday Star Trek fans with interesting stories on how they grew up on Star Trek, or they came into it later in life, or how it's affected them and their relationship. So if any of you listening have an interesting Star Trek story or you know, anything of that nature, contact me at Twitter and maybe we can make a podcast together. So yeah.
All right, sounds cool. And I think Greg may know someone with an interesting story.
I should get in touch with you with one of my friends. We'll stay in touch.
Okay, yeah,
all right,
have your people call my people.
All right. Yeah. All right, well, thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Well, Greg, it's great that we got to talk about Deep Space Nine again, my favorite show, and it's one that we, I guess we've talked about it a fair bit recently, but over the course of The Ready Room, it's probably the show we've talked about the least, I think.
Yeah, probably. I know we keep having this problem of picking the best episodes, and we're doing those first, and
yeah.
We fell into another trap here, I think, because I believe Empire Magazine picked The Search Part 1 and 2 as the best episodes of DS9 out of all of them. So
we're doing it. Yeah, we're doing it on purpose so that, you know, later Ready Rooms, we can really focus on the bad stuff. That's our strategy, you know. So,
you know, year 4, we can really dig into Move Along Home and give it the proper treatment it deserves.
Yeah, and The Children Shall Lead from the original series. We'll get the Royale in there as well.
Right.
A lot of good stuff coming up. So, but anyway, and it was also great that Tristan was able to join us again. Always kind of tough to get Tristan on the show with our recording time during football season. And of course, Brian as well.
Yeah, and actually I wanted to mention real quick, Brian Finifter's show, Down in Front. He does it with a couple guys, Teague Christie, Trey the Amazing Stokes is on there regularly, and also Mike Dortman Scott, who these guys have been friends of mine for years and years, and they've actually been doing this podcast for 2 or 3 years now, and it is a really great podcast. So if you've been on the fence as far as, you know, should I add another podcast to my weekly listening, this really is the podcast to add. So, you know, this is, again, not a paid sponsorship, but this is one of my favorite podcasts, and it really helped me get into podcasting, and it also, you know, adds to my daily humor quotient and also my film knowledge quotient. So downinfront.net for all of your movie podcast needs.
That's right. And that's true. I mean, this is one of your very favorite podcasts. I remember from the time that I very first met you, this was one of the, you know, maybe one of one or two podcasts that you would always talk to me about.
Yeah. So
definitely check that out. All right. Well, let's tell people also where to find us if they have anything to say about what we talked about today or anything about Star Trek in general. Just go over to trek.fm/contact. You'll find our form there where you can send us a text message. And if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can do that. Just call 646-652-TREK. And you can also find us on Twitter at twitter.com/TrekFM. Easy to remember username. And Greg, everyone will find you on Twitter as well, because you always have something really, really riveting going on there.
Do I? I'm trying to remember what I've been saying on Twitter recently.
I think last week you told people you would be talking about knitting hats for glommers or something like that.
Which I'm deep into my glommer hat project, so don't disturb me. Anyway, I can be found on Twitter at Greg Harbin. That's GREGHAR, B as in boy, IN. I did want to mention a tweet from Damon Lindelof, who's writing the new Star Trek film. I retweeted this week. He said, "Every line of Trek script I write is another inspiration for a band name. Full Impulse. Evasive Maneuvers. Damn it, man. The Illogicals."
Yeah.
So if you're not it's on true. Twitter, if you're not on Twitter, you're missing stuff like that. You really are.
Yes. Yes, you are. It reminds me of Dave Barry, the humor writer,
yes,
who
exactly.
isn't so popular these days, but was, you know, over the years when I was growing up and in university and all. Everything he writes reminds him of a band name as well.
Yes.
That's one of his running jokes.
So. Very much.
It's very true. Very true. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And I tweet about all kinds of stuff. If you have any questions about Japan, you can ask me that there. And as football season is soon to be winding down here, thankfully, my alma mater is playing in the national championship game. So I'll be talking about that for a little bit.
Nice.
Until January 9th. But I talk about all kinds of things on there. So you can hook up with me there. And if you do follow Trek FM or me or Greg, just be sure to send us an at reply and say hello so we know that you came in.
Yeah. Did you see, Chris, we got a special celebrity follower at Trek FM this week.
Yes,
Edward
I did.
James Olmos is now following us on Twitter, which
That's right.
I'm deeply, deeply honored, although I think he simply follows back everyone who follows him. So
maybe so. But either way, so say we all.
So say we all.
And there are other places you can find us as well. You can find us over on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM and also on G+ using our short link, hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. All right, Greg. Well, I guess that does it for another Ready Room. I'm going to head out and see if I can get the changelings to hook me up to one of those cool D&D machines.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick Jadzia's wig in it, because the Ready Room is done.